You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Boris Fishman has called his latest novel, Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. It's also the last thing a Montana teenager says to Maya and Alex Rubin, the book's protagonists, after she's driven cross-country to give them her infant son. Maya and Alex accept the blonde-haired baby, whom they name Max, although they had hoped to adopt a child who looked more like them, dark-haired Jewish immigrants. She's from Kiev and he's from Minsk. When the novel opens, Max is 8 years old and he's developed some alarming behaviors. He refuses to sleep in a bed, he eats grass, and he runs away from home to submerge himself in a river. This is Boris Fishman's second novel. It's published by HarperCollins. His first, A Replacement Life, won several awards and was named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year in 2014. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Fishman back to our show today. Hello.
I'm pleased to be back. Thank you, Leonard.
Even before Max starts to behave strangely, didn't Maya and Alex struggle to understand him? Was this a matter of his being American and their being immigrants from the former Soviet Union, or is it just...
That's correct. I mean, this particular bit wasn't part of the original design. Sometimes the design reveals itself to you as you go. What I realized was is the usual story we hear is about American parents adopting kids from Eastern Europe who are misbehaviors. It turns out that I've written a novel about immigrants in America adopting an American boy who's a misbehavior. And the issue here is that Max... despite being quote-unquote native, is a complete foreigner to them.
And Maya and Alex can't help but wonder if every one of Max's quirks or problems is the result of his genes. After all, they're Jewish and Eastern European, and he is the child of devout Christians.
Well, adoptive parents have a problem that birth parents do not, which is this kid being a kid or is this kid being my kid right now? Adoptive immigrant parents, I mean, it's amplified even more so because they're not as familiar with the culture in the first place.
And you have really captured the angst, uncertainty, and absurdity that people experience going through the adoption process. Have you been through it yourself?
No. This was just a sort of a well-intentioned, empathetic fantasy. I wanted to explore something I'd never experienced myself.
So you had to do research or just imagine it?
Half and half. You never want to do too much research, but you want to do just enough.
From the start, Alex insists on a closed adoption, which would mean that he and Maya would have limited or no contact with the child's birth parents, and that their child could never really know his biological parents. Why is it important to Alex for this adoption to be closed?
Purely cultural. I mean, at this point, almost nobody does closed anymore. It is the standard in adoptions to do open. So the child can have access to a personal background. But in Russian culture, a great stigma is applied to adoption. The idea is you're getting a second-class kid, a cast-off. And so Alex, despite having been in America for 25 years, he's this new type of immigrant who sort of keeps his head in the sand. And for him, it's just an embarrassment and a reminder of a personal failure, and he wants no part of it.
But then again, they do meet the mother because she hands them the child.
That's right. The birth parents spring a surprise on the adoptive. And Alex probably would have found a way to ward it off, but it's because of Maya, his wife, who is open to new experience in a way that Alex is not, that they do end up meeting all of them at least once.
Although you've set this novel in 2014, you move the story back and forth in time. Why did you structure it that way? Did you ever consider telling the story chronologically?
It's a really good question. I mean, there's various ways to structure a novel. I'm reading Portrait of a Lady by Henry James right now, and it definitely takes the chronological route. I don't know how that kind of book would have done in the current publishing climate, so I decided to sort of span back and forth to keep my readers with me.
And then there's the whole matter of whether you tell it in the first or third person. Since Maya is really the key figure here, you could have told it in her voice.
That would have been the next step, because obviously my interest here was accessing a female consciousness, again, as part of this effort to just go into another life and see a world through those eyes.
Unlike your first book.
That is correct. I mean, the question always is, how much of that really happened? Well, whether it did or not, we all know that a first novel, to a great degree, is always, it's in some portion autobiographical. Here, I just wanted to travel as far as I could for my own gaze.
Several chapters into the novel, you suddenly jump back to 1992 when Maya and Alex first meet, both fairly new to the United States at that point. How had each of them ended up in the United States?
God, that was my favorite chapter to write. And if readings accommodated 40-minute readings from the novel, I would always read that chapter. There are different people. Alex was a refugee. He came with his family to stay. Maya was not a political refugee. When the wall fell and a student exchange just became possible, she came, she thought, for just a couple of years to get a taste of American life and education and go back. But then that was a plan altered by A, her love affair with Alex, B, the end of the Soviet Union. And so she stays.
But he seemed to be much more committed to the relationship. It's kind of love at first sight for him. For her, you're not sure whether she didn't marry him because her student visa was about to run out.
That's the curse that her mother imagines. Now she would never know. Did she marry the man or the country? But part of the reason they don't go so well together is because Alex is a pretty straight arrow kind of guy, whereas Maya, at least when she was young, was exactly the kind of wild person, which is just to say somebody who follows their own call, that she ends up finding her son to be, her adoptive son, I should emphasize, 20 years later.
When the novel opens, Maya and Alex are living in New Jersey, and Maya performs mammograms at a local hospital. Alex works in his father's import business. Although Alex's parents don't live with Alex and Maya, they always seem to be around. How does Maya feel about having her in-laws so close?
Just as you'd imagine. I mean, there are two kinds of people, the people who think it's a great help and the people who don't. I fall into the latter camp, and I'm with Maya there, because you're basically living in a family where you're married to three people instead of one, and it's maybe one thing if it's your parents and another if it's your husband's.
Well, her mother lives in Ukraine still. It's interesting that grandparents play such a large role in this novel. Didn't they play a big role in the first book as well?
That's absolutely so.
You have a thing about grandparents?
I mean, my I had four parents, perhaps fortunately so. The grandparents have so much to do with bringing up a Russian kid because back in the Soviet Union, there wasn't money for nannies. And you know what? There also wasn't money for separate apartments. A lot of the time, you all lived together. So much like Barack Obama, by the way, who had a lot of upbringing from his grandparents, and a former literary hero, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I'm so close to that kind of storytelling, I don't have to tell your listeners to imagine what it's like to be brought up by a grandparent in addition to a parent. Different dynamic entirely.
I'm speaking with Boris Fishman, whose latest novel is Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. Well, how old were you when you came here from Belarus?
I was 9 years old.
So do you still have strong memories of... Because you've lost the accent totally.
Yes. If you come before your vocal cords fix in place during puberty, you're in luck. I have fragmented memories. It was a very sheltered, sweet, innocent time in a lot of ways, even though life was much more dangerous physically than it was here because we were Jewish. And I think maybe that's part of the reason I don't have any sharp recall of what happened. Most of my recollected trauma happened after immigration.
Although a lot of immigrant families kind of... sustain the kinds of lives they would have lived in the old country, even though they're here.
That is absolutely so. That's exactly the kind of person Alex is. That's what I mean by head in the sand. And America these days makes it possible. Stay in Brighton Beach, don't learn English, and you're still somehow a full-fledged American citizen. How does that work?
Now, I mentioned that Maya is really the central character in this story. And the previous book, your central character was a male. Men tend to write about male characters, female women about female characters. But is there also just the matter of challenging yourself to do something different?
That's absolutely so. And another part of the reason is so many male authors whom I admire, I've just wished for more from them in their portraits of women.
Did you ever consider telling this in first person from Maya's point of view?
You make me regret that I didn't revise it one more time. That's a great idea.
Oh, you thought about it at some point. Maya is a complicated character, partly because she's so unsure of herself.
I love Maya because she's not a saint and she's not a sinner. She's a saint because she's open to new experience, but it's not like she ever makes mistakes. I have a lot of empathy for Alex, who's otherwise kind of a straight arrow schlub, as I mentioned, because he's the one who has to make the trains run on time while she sort of shrapnels herself around looking for new experience and new insight.
On the other hand, she's afraid to fly. She's reluctant to drive.
This is somebody who was very independent and fierce in her youth, who has allowed herself to become circumscribed in a lot of ways as she has gotten older. And through her son's malady, she's forced to reckon with that.
And she's the one who really pushes for the adoption because, as you mentioned earlier, people like Alex and his parents would have considered an adopted child a second-class citizen.
That's correct. A person like Alex says, okay, this didn't work out. We will live with this limitation. That's the quiet heroism of a certain kind of person from Eastern Europe. Maya, who has opened herself to a different kind of perspective on the world, says, well, why do we have to? Yes, it's not what we'd have hoped for, but it is something, and it could be something dear.
Is this just simply their personalities, or the fact that his family comes from Belarus and hers comes from Ukraine?
Well, so one of the questions of the novel is whose child is Max, is sort of in terms of heredity, cultural and otherwise. But its other question is, where do we all get our sense of identity and belonging? How much have they gotten from America? How much have they kept from the old country?
So after Max begins to act strangely, Maya has the idea to take the family on a road trip to Montana to search for Max's biological parents. What does Alex think of that idea?
Same logic. Why do we need to do this? Only fools make unrequired journeys. That's the saying that I invented for this novel as a Russian proverb.
And you invented the Russian proverb.
I did, yeah.
And there are so many Russian proverbs that you could have drawn from.
It turns out they're fairly easy to invent. One part fatalism, one part risk, one part discouragement. Got yourself a Russian proverb.
How do they explain this trip to Max, who doesn't know that he's adopted?
Much like everything else, I think it's another error. They don't tell him enough. They don't tell him where they're going or why.
When you were here last, that was in June 2014, to talk about A Replacement Life, you told me that you'd written 12 drafts of the novel before you were finally happy with it. Did you do something similarly here?
No, this one moved faster. That one was kind of an accelerated graduate school in fiction writing, so that I wrote this one in 4 drafts in a year and a half. But now I'm thinking about number 5 and making it first person.
Well, I have yet to meet a writer who has been totally happy with the book that was finally published. When they read, they always find little phrases that they would like to change, to correct. They think, why did I write that?
I did the audiobook for this one, and it was both exhilarating and oh my God, I used the same word 2 lines in a row. There was quite a few more of those moments than I'd care to share.
A number of writers have told me that it can be really difficult to write a second novel after the first one has received the kind of attention that yours did. Was that your experience?
Let me pass this on as the best sort of lucky advice that I can. Write it before the first one came out.
Write the second one first.
That's right.
Food figures prominently in this novel, and it did in your last one as well. Here, Maya is a fabulous cook, and at one time, she had hoped to open her own cafe. And you give us detailed and mouthwatering descriptions of the traditional Ukrainian dishes that she prepares. So, and you told me that you're actually writing a cookbook now?
That's right. I mean, in a Russian family, food is love. It's how you communicate your admiration of someone, by eating everything that they gave you. And it's also sort of the softener that allows more difficult conversations to be had. But also in my American life, writing is very sedentary. For a break, I've really fallen into volunteer farming. I've been doing that for several summers in a row now. I'm spending this summer in Montana doing the same. And so the result has been...
The Montana connection again.
Again, I've sort of... autobiographical concerns find their way in one way or another. But food's become really important from a lot of angles, and I decided to infuse the novel with it.
Is Belarusian food similar to Ukrainian food?
So they all make the same things. They just insist on calling them different names and insisting that their version is better, but I'm here to tell you that they're identical.
You know that Russian cuisine is not the most highly respected in the world. In fact, the czars all preferred to eat French food.
That is correct.
Although I always wondered what happened when the czar said, let's eat Russian tonight. probably still was blini with caviar, and that wouldn't have been so terrible.
That is correct. I've never really understood the cause, because it's not as if the French use any less butter than the Russians do. The truth, I think, it's part of it is a marketing thing. There's so many wonderful gems in this cuisine that are not gut bombs that I just think it's waiting for a different kind of premiere in American society. That's what I'm trying to do with this cookbook.
So are people surprised that you're writing a cookbook rather than a third novel?
They seem to be both delighted and unsurprised, because food has made its way into so much of the previous two books. It's, in a weird way, it is the natural next step.
I didn't ask you to explain the title, Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo, but I guess listeners can figure that out based on what we've been talking about.
You know, I remember so much about the creation of this book, I have no idea where the title came from.
Oh, yes, you did. My great thanks to Boris Fishman for coming by to talk about his latest book, which is published by Harper. It's great seeing you again.